What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Tannis Development proceeding. Acquire headpiece, staff of Ra, Abner Ravenwood, U.S.
Nazis have discovered Tannis.
Indy racing the Nazis to uncover the lost Ark of the Covenant, one of the great on-screen adventures.
Greatest. Let's just say greatest.
Okay. The greatest on-screen adventure. I'm good with that, but if in some alternative universe Indy asked me to tag along, I don't know.
Nazis the problem, or is it the snakes?
Nazis, snakes, breaking a sweat, all of the above. The top five this week, movie expeditions we'd sign up for, plus a review of the new screen adventure, The Lost City of Z. That and more.
Asps. Very dangerous.
Ahead on Film Spotting. All those years pretending to be Indiana Jones when I was a kid, and when given the chance, purely in my imagination, to join him on one of his adventures, of course I wimp out.
Come on, Kempinar. Grab your makeshift lasso and man up.
It's a whip. Josh, I'll have you know.
It is a whip, isn't it? All those years when I was a kid, I thought it was a lasso.
That's your problem right there. This week's top five movie expeditions we'd sign up for. This is a top five that seemed like a great idea until we realized that our ideal vacation is probably spending the afternoon on the TCM Classic Film Tour bus. That's about my speed.
What's with you? Do we have to have dinner at 4:32? Is that when the tour ends?
Anything that just keeps me comfortable and cool. Don't have to exert myself too much.
Bus.
Those are the expeditions.
Don't open the windows.
I'm after. I'm definitely not interested in the types of expeditions we saw listeners submitting initially when we threw out this topic on social media. A lot of people mentioning Werner Herzog films.
Right.
Have they seen any Werner Herzog films?
I don't think so.
We'll get into that a little bit later here in the show as we do get to that top five. Also, Steve Procopi, a.k.a. Capone from Ain't It Cool News, will join us to talk the upcoming Chicago Critics Film Festival. That kicks off here in mid-May. There are a lot of great titles that have played the festival circuit recently, including this year's Sundance, and we will highlight some of those titles that just may make it out in limited release at some point this year. All that, and everybody's just been clamoring, or not at all, for the return of Massacre Theater. We do have some bad acting with accents coming a bit later in the show as well.
First, though, one thing Indiana Jones was not politically correct. The Lost City of Z features a far more culturally sensitive and factually based explorer in Percy Fawcett. Does his tale make for an equally excellent adventure?
Are you saying Indiana Jones isn't real?
You are the explorer? Give me a hand.
I wish to find a lost city.
What you seek is far greater than you ever imagined. It is your destiny.
We'll not know you when you return.
I know this is a sacrifice for all of us.
The environment's brutally difficult. The journey may well mean your life, but you could reclaim your family name.
Ain't nobody comes back from up there.
But we have never let fear determine our future.
As I suggested before that clip, Adam, Percy Fawcett, the British explorer played by Charlie Hunnam in The Lost City of Z, is something of a woke Indiana Jones. Sent to map the Amazon jungle around 1906, Fawcett returns enamored with the indigenous cultures he encountered and obsessed with a fabled city that is said to lurk deep within the forest. Despite the professional scoffing of his colleagues and the palpable increasing loneliness of his wife, played by a very good Sienna Miller, Fawcett returns to the Amazon three times over the course of his life, determined to prove that white Europeans are not the apex of civilization. This should make Fawcett the perfect hero and The Lost City of Z a welcome film for our socially conscious, critical times, in which issues of identity and representation are at the forefront of so much of our criticism. Vox has a good piece on this trend by Jamie Weinman. How did that element work for you, Adam? Was it a welcome addition to what could be called the conquistador genre, or a preachy distraction? Or maybe you consider it a minor element, and in fact, The Lost City of Z is far more complicated and mysterious than any politically correct spin might suggest.
Well, it wasn't a distraction for me for reasons I'll get to, and I don't know that I'd say I welcomed it so much as I think I understand the director's decision to frame his main character that way. And of course, I say that being somewhat clouded by the fact that I was lucky enough to see this movie a few weekends ago at the Music Box on 35mm, the only print that exists, with the writer and director James Gray in attendance. And there was a Q&A afterwards. So this came up. Actually, I don't even think someone asked about it. He very freely just launched into some discussion of this topic and his reasons. And briefly, I'll note that one of the things he said is that he is making a film very much in the vein of David Lean and Lawrence of Arabia. And whether because of lack of talent or because this mode of filmmaking, that mode of filmmaking that Lean was working in, and that structure where he could go off to the desert and he could harness thousands of extras and not have anybody poking around and wondering what he's doing, he basically could have free rein to make that kind of epic. He can't do that. But what he can do is bring a fresh cultural perspective to the same type of proceeding. So that's his approach, and I'm willing to buy that, but I think there are other reasons for it too. From what I've gathered, Fawcett was definitely more racist in real life than the movie would lead you to believe, in line with the conventional wisdom of the time. And that coupled with, I suppose we should say, a reverence for the native people and their lands makes it more complex, I think. Complex enough that you could devote the entire movie to just that subject. And maybe it would have gotten quite preachy in that process. I don't think this movie ever does. But that subject alone could have consumed the entire movie and our attention as audience members trying to wrestle with those contradictions and reconciling what we know now with what people thought then. I think that would have been great if that was the movie the filmmaker clearly set out to make, and James Gray clearly didn't set out to make that film. So the question is whether his creative license pays off and whether the movie he did make stands on its own merits. And I'd say it absolutely does. And it's a strength of the movie, I'd argue, that each of us could sit here, everybody listening, you, Josh, and we might have very different takes on what we say this movie is ultimately about. For me, and this does get at why Fawcett's Enlightenment didn't bother me, it's a movie about obsession that starts perhaps purely as ambition and becomes about honor. And I want to get into that, but first I'm curious where you came out on your provocative question.
Yeah, I think, you know, it is a talking point around this film, but I am relieved that within the text itself, it does play a minor part. I feel that it gets loudest in that middle section where Fawcett does return and is very intentional and almost self-righteous about
beating down
his colleagues and their racist views of the indigenous people that he's encountered. That's probably that it's almost a courtroom scene.
Yeah.
To me, was the weakest point of the film. But I think you're right in that the movie develops beyond that. And in fact, he initially goes to the Amazon for entirely different reasons. He goes to find status within British society. He's not even that interested in the geography or the culture at all. That's a way for him to gain respect, right? So there's ambition there. And then he comes back and has this newfound obsession with the culture. And that eventually morphs into something else. And there's a turning point. I mentioned, you know, how good Sienna Miller is, because I think there's a crucial scene between them where she asks, I think it's before his third or second trip back. It might be the second. She asks to come along.
Yeah.
And he launches into this, you know, completely sexist.
I think it's the third.
Is it?
Okay. No, actually, you're right. Maybe it is the second, because that's where they have that big scene about his views on what the woman should be doing. I think it's before the second.
And that was crucial to kind of pulling him back from being this saintly hero.
Right.
By the time we're in the third act of this film, it is something completely different, where I'd agree obsession definitely is a part of that, but also this push and pull between cultures, between civilizations, that is no longer in opposition, but the way they've become merged in Fawcett's own mind. And then the question becomes, has he achieved this place or state of nirvana that he has said he's believed in? Or has he lost himself to the point at great cost of his personal life
right.
and his family. That, to me, is the heart of this film, the question that it's about.
Yep.
And it very cleverly and traditionally takes its time getting around to it. But once you're there in that last act, you realize that all that came before was a part of building to that point. And this aspect of him being enlightened is a part of that, but not yeah. the whole thing.
Yeah, that restlessness and that desire to go back to this place juxtaposed with the terror of it and the unknown and the difficulty of it is really what this movie is about in some ways, because I remember very vividly the scene early on in his first journey where he, I think he's just sort of resting at one moment, and he says out loud what I was thinking as an audience member, which is, why did you give up everything you have back at home? That wife, the baby on the way. Maybe you didn't have the status you wanted, but you still were leading a fairly substantial life. Why would you give all that up to be here in this place yeah. right now? And he says it out loud. He verbalizes that, and yet he comes to be the type of man who all he wants to do is be back there. And so that's one of the conundrums of this film. But you touched on everything I wanted to get into in terms of why his enlightenment didn't bother me as something that I felt was inappropriate or didn't feel like it was right for the story, because I would contend that the second time he goes is mostly about status as well. Yes, the first time very clearly is about that. He's going to reclaim his family name, and hopefully there's going to be a little bit of notoriety mm-hmm. for doing this job and doing it well. But I love the first 15 minutes of this film, the way Gray establishes the character and the stakes of the whole film so neatly. This is a guy who we learn has sought every opportunity in his life to distinguish himself as a man, as an Englishman, a man of some nobility despite not being born with any. As I said, we learn that he even does have a little bit of a tarnished family name. And the movie opens with this hunt on horseback. He kills the deer. He hopes that that act might actually get him in the room with the proper people at the party that follows. Whoever it is that's being honored at this event, he's going to be brought in. And he almost succeeds. We hear two men talking about it. They're about to invite him in, and then one of them says to the other that Fawcett was rather unfortunate in his choice of ancestors,
yeah.
which is the line
what
of the film.
Great phrasing.
So
right?
good. And they turn their backs, and they go in without him. So when he stands before the Royal Geographic Society, when he's returned, the scene you're talking about that you didn't really like, and he seems to have such a sophisticated view of the natives, and he's harangued for it. And he then in turn takes great pride in rebuking them for their lack of, more than anything, imagination, I'd say. I thought that was completely consistent with the Fawcett character and his motivations. This is his route, not just to being accepted by these people, but to being superior to these people and establishing a legacy that outlives him or most mortals. And at this point, he hasn't even really encountered many natives. His big breakthrough doesn't happen until that return trip. So I think there's a lot of delusion at play here. And he believes at this point in these natives. His righteousness is driven by his need to believe in this lost city, to get what he wants, to be the man he wants to be, and to deny the establishment. One of the things I scribbled in my notes, one of the few things I could read, was he's open-minded when it suits him. He's quite closed-minded when it doesn't suit him, as we see in that conversation with his wife.
I do believe I am quite ready to accompany you on your next journey.
What do you mean?
The children will be back in school by then. And I have learned to read the stars and navigate. I've become very well versed in the history of the region. After all, it is I who found the document.
I know, darling. But that would be impossible. It's not a place at all for a woman.
Not a place for a woman.
Yes.
We believe firmly in the equality between us.
In equality, yes, but in mind, not in body.
Delusion is a good word, and wrestling with what levels of delusion are at work here mm-hmm. for this Fawcett character. I also want to return to another phrase you used referencing the South American jungle that he finds himself in, the terror of it. We should talk about the aesthetic of this film mm-hmm. that James Gray, working with cinematographer Darius Kanji, creates. It is so lush, yet always open to the terror of this landscape. It's as if the fronds are made of poisonous velvet because you can feel the softness of them. And at the same time, you recognize the danger that lies beneath them, just past where you can see.
Mm-hmm.
And I found Gray's last film, The Immigrant. I was a little bit on the outside looking in with that one.
We were together on that one.
Okay. Yeah. I think we didn't review it together, though. I think I was on with Michael, perhaps. But that's right. I remember
we were split.
You weren't
on the film. We were mixed on it. Both.
We were both mixed. And one of the reasons was that I felt the lustrousness, also working with Kanji, was too precious.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Here, it is. There is just as much attention paid to every single image, yet I think the balance they find is weaving it into – here's delusion again.
Mm-hmm.
The fantasy version of the Amazon that exists in Fawcett's head and the terrible version that he's actually experiencing.
Yeah.
My favorite image of this film is on the first trip when one of the explorers goes overboard, gets trapped in the net – and the piranha attack. And we see this from under the water looking up, and the way the sunlight comes down, the figure is in this shadowy, it's almost a Rembrandt portrait as he's writhing around. It is absolutely gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it's a vision of horrifying
it
death.
Is.
And the way Gray mixes those two and Kanji again just captures that interior state of mind that Fawcett has in such a way that I – not that you have to forgive this level of gorgeousness in a film, but sometimes you have to justify it.
Mm-hmm.
And The Lost City of Z, for me, completely justifies it. In fact, I think it makes up for – and we'll maybe get to this in a little bit
– yeah,
Hunnam's performance, where there are ways I wish Hunnam had been able to do that with his performance – and the images pick up the slack.
Well, we may disagree a little bit about Hunnam here in a moment, but you're absolutely right about the way this film is shot and that being a strength of this film. There is a more subdued amber glow to everything here versus what we saw in The Immigrant that does feel appropriate. I love the way you describe it in terms of it being almost his fantasy version of this place. We're seeing it through his eyes. And look, he can also do great closing shots. The Immigrant may be overstaged a little bit, but still the most interesting thing about the film for me, ultimately, this is a much more subtle version of that, but similarly says so much with a silent shot.
The closing shot.
The closing shot of this film.
He nails it.
He nails it.
This is what The Immigrant I tried to do if it didn't work for you, but this is my level.
It's wonderful, and there are other examples of it. The other one I would point to, and I think this gets back to what we were saying with the scene where she makes the case for going and then she gets left behind. But the movement of the camera, there's that tracking shot where he's leaving.
The train station.
And then it's mirrored. It's this match of movement, right, when she's back in her room. She's stuck. He's heading off to glory. She's stuck back at home. But it's the same sweep of motion to it. And that, of course, just belies her being stuck. It's wonderful.
The camera pans past the train station as he leaves, and then instantaneously it pans at the same speed past her bed where she's alone. Maybe 3 seconds of screen time.
Yeah.
And again,
but it
up
says
there
it,
in the top five
yeah,
moments.
It says it all visually. And there are some other wonderful little touches, and this is a little more ostentatious. And at the same time, I wouldn't describe it as being distractingly so. And at the Q&A, he pointed out that it was very much a clear homage to Lean. And it's the shot when he is on the train after meeting Robert Pattinson for the first time, and he suggests to him that he can't be drunk on this trip, and the bottle falls, and the camera then goes to the ground as we see just the trickle of the liquor as it's moving along the train. And what does he cut to then? He cuts to the train on the tracks moving with the smoke coming out. And the movement of the train matches that movement across screen of the liquor. And he points out that that's one of those nods to one of the great match cuts of all time, which is the flame shot in Lawrence of Arabia to then the hot desert sun. But I do, of course, love little flourishes like that. I'll point out as well, one of the things that really struck me is the use of sound, especially when they're in the jungle, and off-screen sound. There's lots of times where characters look at things or are distracted by something that then Gray doesn't really show us. And I think that adds to the terror a little bit because we don't know what it is. The main characters may not even know what it is, but we hear it. And so we're always on alert. And I think we are always forced a little bit to use our imagination. And I like that sort of active viewership that Gray gives us here.
So what about Hunnam? What'd you like about him?
Well, I'll say this. I was with you on his performance in Pacific Rim. We very much disagreed on that film. I thought that Del Toro movie was a lot of fun, but I thought his lead performance was pretty bland, and even if the movie just needed him to be bland, that wasn't quite good enough for me. What I think he does capture here, first of all, he does show more range than I ever thought he had as an actor.
I would agree with that.
Okay, so I was surprised by the performance, but I think he really captures Percy Fawcett as a capable, intelligent man who nevertheless is just always punching above his weight class a little bit. He might be the most perfectly cast person for this role. There is a little bit of desperation and a striving that I think is necessary in this performance with this character that Hunnam delivers. One scene I like that comes later in the film when he's an older version of Percy Fawcett and he has now been home from that second journey. And you can tell that he still has that wanderer spirit in him where he comes home. And just the posture, his physicality, and then what he says to his son, he says, "Has anybody walked the dog yet?" He just walked in the door. And yet you can tell he's looking for any excuse to get out of the house. He doesn't feel at home in that house. And I think not only with that line, but physically, I think Hunnam really expresses that. And I want to point out one other scene that he really performs nicely. There's a moment after the second journey. We won't get into what goes on or what goes wrong on that trip, but he has to come back and have a little bit of a courtroom scene, smaller courtroom scene at the Royal Geographic Society. And he has this wonderful confrontation with Angus McFadden. That scene requires a deftness of tongue and fortitude to make it a rousing scene where you almost want, as an audience member, to stand up and clap when it's done. And if the actor doesn't do it, it's just going to be an absolute dud. And I think Hunnam nails it.
Yeah, that scene works. And he does a nice shift there, too, where at the beginning of the scene, Fawcett is willing to concede that argument and then makes a turn suddenly and stands his ground. And yeah, he does show more range here. This is far better than Pacific Rim. And it's a fine performance. What I think was lacking, it was a matter of the other elements of the film working at such a high level that he wasn't quite able to match, in that he projected this outward conviction, his posturing, you know, he has like the chin is out and he speaks very declaratively.
Right.
And yes, you're right. Like that does
he's
reveal
trying
the man,
too hard.
Right. The man he's trying to be.
But so is the character.
But what I did want is, again, what the images captured is the feeling of this obsession, the inner drive behind the obsession. It was he projected outwardly what the character wanted to present. But part of the main question here is, again, how much is he deluding himself? What's really going on in his head? How much is this tension between home and travel something that he's wrestling with? And that inner element is what was a little bit lacking. And so, you know, probably, far better than the other things I've seen him in. It's just something that I wish he could have met the film at the level it was working on otherwise.
Yeah, and he's co-starring here with Robert Pattinson, who is, I would say, by far the more interesting actor, stuck with by far a less interesting and underdeveloped character.
Totally.
As his sidekick, that is unfortunate. There's a darkness and there's a mystery. All those things that you're hinting at that you sort of wanted, Pattinson delivers that in spades with almost any character we've seen him play recently. He's a more fascinating puzzle as an actor, without a doubt. I guess I would just argue I'm not totally convinced that those types of qualities in a lead performance would have actually made for a better Percy Fawcett, because I don't know that that's the Fawcett that Gray is presenting anyway.
I think they might have illuminated the final third, which, again, the mystery of it, this is when he returns for his third trip, becomes much more involved with one of the tribes, to the point where we're wondering, we'll just say, is he going to come back? What choices is he going to make in this situation? What choices does he have in this situation? And Hunnam gets set aside in a way that was okay, but again, because the filmmaking rises here to such a level of it almost becomes this metaphysical experience, the end of this film,
yeah.
where, again, going back to the idea of Europe and South America often passing in the night throughout the film. I love where there are edits when he's in the jungle, a quick insert shot mm-hmm. of his wife back, or even that wonderful scene when he's in the trenches in World War I talking to a palm reader, I believe yeah. she is, and all of a sudden the background of the trenches disappears and they're in the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This melding of worlds comes together completely in the final third
it
because
does.
Of the imagery. And we just feel, in a good way, I felt at a loss. You don't know where you are anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in his head, right? And that is entirely because of the camera work, the lighting of the scene, of the ceremony that's taking mm-hmm. place, what we're allowed to see and what's left outside of that ring of light. The way campfire and firelight is used in this film is so important because it always leaves a segment of encroaching darkness on the screen, that segment of mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that is used in the finale as well is just this is quite an experience to get to that last 20 minutes and realize what the film has sort of morphed into.
So fair to say that neither of us would sign up to go along with Percy Fawcett on any of these journeys?
I don't think so.
But we are on board with James Gray's film, The Lost City of Z, which is currently playing in limited release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Friend of the show, Steve Procopi, drops by next to share a sneak preview of next month's Chicago Critics Film Festival. And now that I've finally earned my advanced degree in drama from Juilliard...
That's where you've been.
It's the return of Massacre Theater. Stay with us.
First there will bend in the moon, it will send slide down your collar, your bones they will mend, I know they will. Ooh. All quarried out, you stand. I know your stormlight will rise up again across the wave.
Now, whatever you do, don't push this button, because that will set off the bomb immediately and we'll all be dead. Now repeat back what I just said.
I am Groot.
No! No, that's the button that will kill everyone. Try again.
I am Groot.
Mm-hmm.
I am Groot.
Uh-huh.
I am Groot.
No!
Baby Groot and Bradley Cooper's Rocket the Raccoon, I maintain, still his best performance mm-hmm, to date.
Of course you do.
In Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, the movie we plan to review on next week's show. Along with our summer movie preview, of course, we do it the Film Spotting way. We will be sharing our top five questions of the summer movie season. My question is whether you will have a good time at Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, because you didn't have much of a good time with the first one, even though the rest of the world did.
Yeah, I wasn't one of the cool kids. I was on the outside looking in with Guardians of the Galaxy. Didn't hate it, but mm-hmm. had some major reservations. Rewatched it to, you know, find out how wrong I might have been. And
you were still,
you know,
wrong.
There's still some stuff I like about it, but the main problems, which maybe we'll get into in our review, were still there. So can't say I'm you know, chomping at the bit to see this one, but I don't want to be left out. So let's check it out. Let's see what happens.
Well, you are chomping at the bit to promote your book.
Been doing a lot of that.
Do we go ahead and point out
to
listeners
like that about a month away here? You know?
About a month away, we actually have cameras in studio right now, all for promotional purposes. I think they've picked up on the fact that you're the brains and I'm the looks.
Probably.
I've noticed a lot of close-ups and not much gauzy lighting. So I appreciate that.
You are kind of the Mimbo of the operation. Yeah. Everyone,
fair enough.
Everyone knows that. So the book promotional tour, June 13, Movies Are Prayers. It's coming out soon. I've been doing a lot of appearances, and the next one coming up I want to let people know about is this free screening we're doing of the film Heaven Can Wait. It's going to be May 6th at the Chicago Cultural Center, Saturday morning, so 10 a.m. we're doing this. This is Ernst Lubitsch's comedy about a rogue who debates his fate with Satan after he dies. And it's put on by Chicago's Music of the Baroque. So we're going to be connecting the film to George Telemann's The Day of Judgment, which they're performing May 14 and 15. So a 1943 Lubitsch film, an 18th century oratorio, both involving the afterlife. We'll see what connections we can make there.
Yeah. No, that should be fun. I mean, not that I'm going to attend at 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning, but I
think
it
would be... What, you got to go to the post office or something?
Probably.
Actually, that is what you usually do on Saturday mornings.
Yeah, we also wanted to put in a plug for the Chicago Film Society because they have screenings at the Music Box and on the Bronzeville campus of Northeastern Illinois University. A great lineup. We'll say that. We'll link to the full lineup in our show notes, and you can also find that information at chicagofilmsociety.org. But I also wanted to highlight them because, as we touched on during The Lost City of Z, I saw that movie with James Gray in attendance, and the Chicago Film Society made that happen. They're the ones who hosted that screening. 35-millimeter print of the film, which is very rare. I think one other festival showed it, but otherwise, that's not how you're going to see the movie. So I feel pretty blessed to have had that opportunity, and I thank the Chicago Film Society for it.
I was very jealous of that. Saw it at a regular theater, and got to say, it was a little dark, a little dim, so wish I had seen that 35-millimeter print.
We also wanted to highlight our current marathon. We are almost done, five films into our sixth film, Agnes Varda Marathon. It returns this week after a little break. This time, for our podcast listeners, if you are subscribed to the show, you already got the show. We actually posted it before you even got to this episode. So if you didn't see it pop up, look for it in your feed. This week, we're talking about Varda's 2000 doc, The Gleaners and I.
As always, our marathon is sponsored by MUBI, cult classic independent films from around the world. Every day, MUBI's experts introduce you to a film they love, and then you have a whole month to watch it. That means there's always 30 extraordinary films for you to enjoy. Now, listeners of Film Spotting, you can try MUBI free for a month. Just go to MUBI.com/filmspotting. That's MUBI.com/filmspotting to redeem now.
So we have some other thank yous, and I will give you some credit here because I was expecting that huge charge to come through on the Film Spotting credit card for drinks out in Colorado, and it seems like you had a fairly modest affair.
We were teetotalers. Is that what it is? Teetotalers?
Yeah.
I don't know. I say it, but I don't do it.
No, you
it
don't mean it because it's not true.
I didn't buy a drink for anybody else. That whole bill was just me. No, look at you're worried. I'm kidding.
How am I going to write it off?
I covered the bill. Yeah, now I realize these are fundraising campaigns that you're doing too.
That's true. People end up donating after I buy them a beer and we make out.
Right. We'll see what happens with this. But I did have a really good time hanging out with a bunch of people after the Ebert Interruptus event out in Boulder. I want to say thanks to Ernie Quiros. He's with the Denver Film Society. Jeremy Doan, Kenny Meyer, Scott Lunt. Also, this wasn't that night, but at the conference itself, I met the parents of Chicago listener and Columbia College film student Cole Bradley. They're very proud of you, Cole.
I'm sure they are.
Let me just say that. Of course, all of this was organized by Boulder Weekly film critic Michael J. Casey. He was there that night too. So yeah, we had a lot of good movie talk, got some focus group questioning going on about the show itself. Maybe I'll share some of that with you.
Yeah, I need the research. I need the data.
It has to do with your staggering good looks mostly. So yeah, I'll fill you in.
I'm all in favor of your findings. Speaking of findings and data, we have some poll results over at filmspotting.net, the new and improved filmspotting.net, just launched this week. And we've got a surprisingly compelling poll question, surprising to those of us who came up with the question. You're at a movie theater. You have to choose between four films. The only thing you know about them is the 1990 Born Star. And we were inspired to do this because we thought we were going to talk about The Circle, the new film starring Tom Hanks and Emma Watson, she of being born in 1990. We decided to go Guardians of the Galaxy instead, but we gave you these choices: J-Law, K-Stew, M-Rob, and E-Watts.
What? You lost me at the end there.
Now you know who E. Watts is because I said Emma Watson. M-Rob, that would be Margot Robbie. And okay. if those abbreviations, those little nicknames didn't quite work, that tells you who is currently losing this poll question resoundingly.
I don't think those last two are OK Magazine approved.
I don't think they are either.
Is that a celebrity magazine?
OK. Sure.
I think it is.
Maybe from 20 years ago.
I don't know.
But over 1,000 votes cast, Josh, and Lawrence and Stewart, as of this taping, separated by fewer than 10. This is the DiCaprio v. Damon deathmatch of 2017.
That's right.
We may not get better than this. And in the undercard, yes, Watson and Robbie also separated by fewer than 10 votes. So the madness continues here with our film spotting poll questions. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. The poll closes Monday, May 1st, 5 p.m. Central Time. Massacre Theater is back, Josh. I hope you're ready.
Are you in form? Are you in shape for this?
Not at
all. Your skills a little flabby?
Not at all. But let's do it.
Ta-tay-tee-toe-too.
No, no, Miss Lamont. Round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
Those singing in the rain diction lessons could come in really handy with this Massacre Theater, Josh, because we are both attempting accents this time.
Dueling accents.
We've had all this time. It's been a couple of months since we did the last Massacre Theater scene because of film spotting madness. And yet, did we take any time to actually prepare to pick out a scene months in advance to learn our lines?
Do you think we'd have one in the pipeline ready to go?
I don't know. Maybe even take some lessons on how to do an accent. Well, then it wouldn't be Massacre Theater. So we'll tell you this. It ties in with our top five this week, movie expeditions. We'd sign up for. Maybe we'd sign up for this one. That remains to be seen. Also remaining to be seen whether or not this one actually counts as an expedition. I would argue not.
You're not on board with it as an expedition. I think it counts loosely.
It's close enough.
One
of the characters.
When we didn't have a scene 2 hours ago, suddenly it became close enough.
One of the characters in this scene definitely wants to go on an expedition.
Okay, that works.
And I would be intrigued by that one, but it's not the main mission these folks are on. I'm going to start it off. I think, Josh, are you ready? You give me the action.
And action.
You've pushed them too hard.
I invite you to this cabin as my friend, not to criticize nor to comment on my command.
Well, shall I leave you until you're in a more harmonious frame of mind?
What would you have me do?
Tip the ship's grog over the side.
Stop their grog.
Niggle was drunk when he insulted Holland. Did you know that?
Stop 200 years of privilege and tradition. I'd rather have them 3 sheets to the wind on occasion than have a mutiny on my hands.
See, I'm rather understanding of mutinies. Men pressed from their homes, their chosen occupations, confined for months aboard a wooden prison.
I profoundly respect your right to disagree with me here in this cabin, but I can only afford one rebel on this ship. I hate it when you talk of the service in this way. It makes me so very low.
And scene. Was that an accent, Josh?
I might have been going so fast I forgot the accent.
You were going very fast, and the last thing I want to do is make you feel low. So
meanwhile,
let's move on.
You had a little grog before that performance. Things got a little slurry.
Indeed. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, May 8th.
The winner will be elected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
He'll be what randomly?
Erected.
That's me, Father, for I've sinned. I have slept with another man's wife. Sometimes she would place her mouth around my sex.
No, that's sodomy.
I thought sodomy was just when someone would penetrate the rear.
That's also sodomy.
Right.
Did you do that?
I did.
And that's actually the cleanest bit we could play from the Red Band trailer for The Little Hours. John C. Reilly and Dave Franco in that clip from the explicit comedy set in a medieval convent. Alison Brie and Aubrey Plaza also star. It's one of the films making its Chicago debut at the Chicago Critics Film Festival, which kicks off in a couple of weeks. Here to fill us in on some of the big titles that have been programmed this year, Steve Procopi, a.k.a. Capone, from Ain't It Cool News. Steve, how are you?
I'm good. Glad to be back. You know, this is this time of year, right, when I come on this show every year, it just so happens that just talking about the festival at length, it's really the first time I get to do it because usually we're just talking about one movie at a time. Mm-hmm. And This is when the panic starts to set in, and it doesn't really end until the festival's over.
Like, so what is the panic?
Yeah,
for
I'm glad you could associate us with panic.
It does because it's really the first time I'm looking at the whole thing and realizing that there are so many places where something could go wrong, or someone could drop out, or a film.
Lots of moving parts.
Yeah, it's so many, and they don't stop moving once the festival starts.
Yeah.
You know, they just stop moving after the guest has gone for the night, and then you move on to the next day, and it starts all over again.
Yeah, so, you are one of the people behind the scenes putting this fest together. It does open May 12th. It closes May 18th. More information at ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com. The titles have been released, and we played that clip from The Little Hours, which is actually the opening night film, and I know it's one you wanted to highlight.
It's a film that a lot of us saw at Sundance this year, where it premiered. It's just one of the funniest things I have seen still all year. It's based on the Decameron, so it's, you know, these 14th century nuns and monks and peasants and lords and ladies, and it's actually, I mean, the filmmaker, Jeff Baena, who did a movie we had at our festival last year called Joshi, he was, I guess, a history major or minor as well as a film student wherever he went to school. It might have been NYU, and so he loves this stuff, and there's a lot about this film that is actually quite historically accurate, other than the language. But all of the stories in the Decameron that he pulled to make this, you know, they're all about horny nuns and bad priests and sex-crazed peasant boys, and that's the movie. And it's great. It's very funny.
Are you telling me this is better than Your Highness?
Well, yeah, a little bit, maybe.
Okay.
Well, I was sold with John C. Reilly, but the rest of the cast is great as well. That's Friday night, May 12th. Take us into Saturday.
Well, actually, we should mention about that before we move on, that we have some of the, like, Jeff Baena, the writer-director, will be there, as well as two of the three main horny nuns, Aubrey Plaza and Kate Micucci, will both be there. So, and that has already sold a lot of tickets, so there's a very good chance it will sell out.
Yeah,
so I'm just saying, you might want to buy your tickets early for that one.
The special guests are always a big highlight of this festival. So we get to Saturday. And a film from a new director, though not a new face. You may not know his name, though if you saw him, you would go, oh yeah, that's Marge's husband, or the Zodiac Killer, John Carroll Lynch.
100 times over, you would know John Carroll Lynch's face, yes. And his film is called Lucky, and he did not write it, but it is very much an effort to capture the personality of Harry Dean Stanton in this fictional character, but a lot of what he does at 90 years old, that's how old Harry Dean Stanton is, it sort of embodies a lot of what he believes and a lot of way he behaves and his philosophies about life and being alone and being a part of a community. And I don't want to say too much about it. It's a very simple film, but wow, by the end of it, you are just so moved by this performance and some of the people in it. There aren't a lot of famous people in it. There are a few cameos here and there, including actually a really fun one by David Lynch as one of Lucky's regular cohorts at his watering hole that he stops in every night. So, but yeah, I cannot recommend it enough. John Carroll Lynch will be there. So you should absolutely – I got a great chance to talk to him at South by Southwest where the film premiered a couple months ago. And boy, he just has a lot to say, and he's a lot of fun to talk to. And I guarantee you the audience will love him. So
we were talking a little bit before we started recording here, and you mentioned that one of the other films is a revival of Southland Tales, and how you're hoping this will maybe jumpstart a little bit of a – appreciation or reappreciation for that Richard Kelly bomb, I guess we could call it. I'm all on board for that because I like this movie quite a bit when it initially came out.
Of course you did.
It's shocking,
I was
Adam,
just
I'm sure.
About to search your archive.
And I was feeling very lonely during that year that it came out. What was that? Oh, what year was that?
Three stars.
It was 10 years old.
2007.
It's 10th anniversary.
Three out of four from one Josh Larson.
Reappreciation is what's going to happen because that movie was a prediction of an insane future that I have a feeling we're going to recognize
when we watch the movie again. Quite as crazy, or at least quite as out there as it probably did 10 years ago. And it's really strange how this came together because it just so happens that the five programmers, and we have very different tastes, we all really like this movie. Not all of us right when it came out, but even some of us had rediscovered it in the years since it came out. But we all liked it, and we were really searching. We wanted to find a good archival film to play. We were sort of looking at the midnight slots, but at some point, this just came up because we just happened to be looking at films celebrating anniversaries. And this one, and it, as soon as the words came out of whoever said it out of their mouths, we're like, that's it. We knew it was like, we knew we had access to a 35 millimeter print of it, which I hear is very good. And then we just sort of contacted Richard Kelly, and eventually we were going to play it anyway. So whether he came or not, but then I think he just might have been astonished enough that we were doing it and that critics were celebrating it, that he said, yeah, sure. So
that's great.
He will be there.
My character, he realizes that the apocalyptic crime rate is because of global deceleration. The rotation of the Earth is slowing down at a rate of 0.000000006 miles per hour each day, disrupting the chemical equilibrium in the human brain, causing very irrational criminal behavior.
Yeah, I did not appreciate it quite as much as you, Josh, though I remember on some level appreciating just how insane it was. Yeah. It wasn't a total write-off. There's no way you could completely write off
the
a movie
audacity,
that has that much audacity and its conviction. So I would be on board with watching that movie again. Absolutely. We have one more movie we want to highlight here, and it is The Closing Night Film, a movie that I recall coming up, I think, Josh, when we did our most anticipated movies of the year. I don't know if it actually made our list or was an honorable mention, but I know this film from the director of Ain't Them Bodies Saints and his follow-up film,
Pete's Dragon,
David Lowery. He's got The Closing Night Film. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this was that little secret film he made as soon as he wrapped the filming of Pete's Dragon. He had this script called A Ghost Story. He just reunited his Ain't Them Bodies Saints stars, Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck. And they just made this movie very quickly, very quietly. I don't think people even knew it existed until shortly before Sundance. And it is surreal. It's fascinating. And it's really, really moving. And I think it's one of the, I don't think there's any question it's going to make my 10 best of the year list. And I'm not even sure, sitting here, I'm not sure I could explain why. I've already written my review, so I've already sort of put it all out there. But it is really unlike anything I've ever seen before.
This is probably my big regret from Sundance, because as soon as people started seeing it, the word really spread, and I just couldn't fit it into my schedule. So I'll be looking forward to this one quite a bit.
Yeah, you've got me hooked. That is A Ghost Story. It is the closing night film of the Chicago Critics Film Festival. That would be May 18th. One more movie we are going to mention, because we're going to give away some movie passes. It's The Hero, and this film plays on Sunday, May 14th, 7 p.m. It's from director Brett Haley, and the movie stars the great Sam Elliott, Nick Offerman, also in this film, The Hero. Just tell us a little bit about it.
It's about a person, an actor very much like Sam Elliott, although this version of this character is best known for one particular role. And then ever since then, he's been sort of riding that train.
Mm-hmm.
But he's one of these guys that does a lot of voiceover work because his voice is great. And he does a lot of small bit parts in TV shows and movies. But he's never really done anything as remarkable as that one movie called The Hero. And we see little clips of it in the film. And it's sort of how he's responding to getting older. And just, it's weird seeing Sam Elliott on a cell phone. Like, that's something you don't see a lot. And
and
I was told, Brett Hawley told me when I interviewed him that
he said, he was inside a phone booth when he made the call.
Right. No, he said that he actually learned to text on the movie set.
Really?
Like, he'd never done that before. He had a phone, but he basically just used it as a phone. So, but yeah, no, It's just a very tough movie to watch sometimes, about a struggling actor just trying to build up a little steam in the last few years of your life, I guess. And it's very good, and it's maybe one of the best things I've ever seen Sam Elliott do.
So a movie that's very meta about movies that is also about mortality. I don't know if I'm going to see this one, Josh. I may have to sit this one out. Oh, and it stars Sam Elliott. So yes, we are going to give away 25 passes. Do we get to give away a guest to come with him?
Brett Hawley will be there. Yes.
No. If Josh wins a pass, does he get to bring his wife?
Oh, I'm saying, I was assuming it was 25 pairs.
There you go.
Of course.
Very generous from the Chicago Film Critics Association. All you have to do is email feedback@filmspotting.net. Put The Hero in the subject line, and in the body of the email, you have to tell us your favorite Sam Elliott performance. It can't be in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, you got to go deeper than
you have
that.
To pick anything other than
I do that
the Big
sometimes
Lebowski.
Too. Take out the most obvious uh-huh. answer and then see, make them dig a little deeper. Yeah.
Well, the fest sounds amazing, and I can't wait to see some of these movies. The dates again, Friday, May 12th through the 18th. Are all the titles playing at the Music Box?
Yes, every one of them. There's a couple that are playing twice even. So we're doing afternoon matinees again for the second year, which we did not do in the beginning. And that actually turned out really well for us last year. People actually – there are people that – retired people, people that live in the Southport area just come over for the matinees.
Sure.
Yeah, it was actually kind of a nice surprise.
More information at ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com. Steve Procopi, thank you so much. Where can people find more of your work?
Ain'titcool.com.
There
Thanks,
you have
Steve. It. Thank you very much.
We're losing Steve on this expedition. I think he's coming down with dengue fever. But Adam and I will carry on when we come back. It's the Film Spotting Top 5 movie expeditions we'd sign up for. Stay with us. You got a love. I'll be your sail. Find the light source in the storm of your head.
Your mission is to proceed up the Nung River in a Navy patrol boat. Pick up Colonel Kurtz's path at Nu Mung Ba. Follow it, learn what you can along the way. When you find the Colonel, infiltrate his team by whatever means available. And terminate the Colonel's command.
Terminate the Colonel.
And another movie expedition I would happily sit out. Don't get off the boat. Don't ever get off the boat.
You're running out of options here. I can't wait to see what's actually on
We'll see what I came
list.
Up with.
You know, going to 7-Eleven to pick up a candy bar doesn't count
that's
as
not,
an expedition,
That's not an
Adam.
Expedition?
No. Clerks, not allowed.
That was my number one. Man, Martin Sheen and a less adventurous Harrison Ford in that scene from, of course, Apocalypse Now. It is top five time, and this week, tying in with the Lost City of Z, we are doing the top five movie expeditions we'd sign up for. Expeditions, fair to say, different from missions, perhaps.
Probably.
And I would also say maybe different from missions of the war variety, where you don't really have much of a choice in being part of that.
You set aside wars. You know
I did.
That's all right.
I didn't even
That's
consider
right.
it.
Because Works for me.
Also, why would I sign up to go fight in a war?
Yeah, you're not doing that.
No. And I can't wait to hear if you would, Josh. That must be some cause. So.
I enlisted yesterday, Adam.
Okay. Well, the show's over, everyone. But Apocalypse Now, not eligible anyway because it's in the Pantheon. Raiders of the Lost Ark. That one may be a little bit more likely. That's a pretty great artifact. Who wouldn't want to hang out with Indiana Jones? And we can talk about whether or not we get to do that in this imaginary top five. But they're not eligible because of their Pantheon status, along with a host of other films that we didn't really consider, but listeners might. We deem them ineligible. And this was a fun topic. Our producer, Sam Van Halgren, came up with it. I'm very glad that he did. And our FAB, the Film Spotting Advisory Board, was very helpful for me on this one, and they had fun with it as well. To set this up, I felt like we just had to share these comments from Martin Teller, longtime FAB member. He said, how about these options? A lovely visit to Pagan Summer Isle with Sergeant Howie in The Wicker Man! Exclamation points here. Catch the stunning view from the top of the bell tower at Mission San Juan Batista in Vertigo. Discover what strange mysteries lurk beyond the infinite in 2001. Unlock the answers you're seeking in The Zone with the assistance of a helpful stalker. For those looking to get in touch with nature, how about a picnic at Hanging Rock? So you can see that there are lots of great
like a travel
films,
agent, isn't
yeah,
it?
That deal with expeditions of a sort, but whether or not you as an individual would want to be part of them is the big question. And I was surprised, Josh, by how many people did write in immediately on Twitter and Facebook and even via email and said, yeah, Apocalypse Now or Aguirre, the Wrath of God and Fitzcarraldo, those Herzog films, Sorcerer, the William Friedkin movie. Josh, I don't know if you've seen Sorcerer, but this is a film about transporting nitroglycerin across really awful terrain. Do the people who submitted Sorcerer remember Roy Scheider's eyes by the end of that film and that bridge crossing sequence? No, thank you.
A lot of death wishes out there is what I picked up on.
A lot of death wishes. The other fun part is when my wife, Sarah, said to me, so what's the top five? What are you working on? I said, movie expeditions we'd sign up for. And she said, but you have such a lack of a sense of adventure. How are you going to come up with anything?
She knows you so well.
I mean,
well.
She does know me very well. We'll see how I did. But Josh, you are up first.
And I didn't have quite as many limitations as you, it sounds like, but I did have some. Drew the line at cold. I don't do cold.
Love it. I'm more of a non-heat guy.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Why the jungle's out.
I would rather sweat than shiver any day.
Okay.
I get enough cold here in Chicago. I don't have a death wish. I did consider my safety. So I'm not saying these are all entirely safe, but certain death I set aside, which means...
Some of mine are really safe. They're really safe.
Well, for me, a lot of people obviously suggested you're going to go Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, right? But, you know, we all know that's an illegal suicide mission with a selfish maniac. I'm not doing that. So I had to find that balance of appealing adventure, but no real threat of death and no shivering. Those were kind of my guidelines.
Okay.
So let's start with Creature from the Black Lagoon. Now, I'm not Percy Fawcett, the lost City of Z explorer who is obsessed with the Amazon, but I will say I've had a fascination with the region really since I was a little kid. I used to subscribe to this magazine. Maybe it was more like a catalog. I don't know. It was put out by the Earthwatch Institute, and they ran these citizen scientist expeditions around the world, like legit expeditions. I remember trying to convince my grandfather to sign up for one of these to the Amazon River, like the two of us would go. This would be great, right? Never really happened. But I think Earthwatch is still around, so maybe I'll still get my chance at them. One of the pop culture bits that fed this imagination I had was 1954's Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Okay.
This is where a crew of scientists encounter a prehistoric fish man in an Amazonian inlet. I think it played on Channel 9 like all the time.
It's amazing. It's incredible. Could it possibly belong to a Pleistocene man?
The chances are much greater that that hand belonged to an amphibian, Mark. One that spent a great deal of time in the water.
Well, then how do you account for the structure of the fingers? Obviously for land use. What do you think, Dr. Matos?
We can be sure of one thing. Whatever it was very powerful. You say you have hopes of finding the rest of the fossil?
As soon as I get a suitable expedition together.
Well, why don't we make up the expedition?
Now, I defended this creature feature on episode 507, where I listed it as one of my top five movie manimals. I know it still kills you that you had to miss out on that program, Adam.
Yeah.
That was with Michael Phillips. I'm still waiting for your list, by the way, so send that to me as soon as you get a chance.
Uh-huh.
I'm choosing Creature from the Black Lagoon again here because of its eerily beautiful aquatic cinematography. That shot I mentioned in The Lost City of Z is drawn, James Gray likely is not going to cite it. It's not David Lean exactly, this movie. But I'm telling you, the imagery is drawn or reminiscent at least exactly of some of the stuff that's going on in Creature from the Black Lagoon. So I also picked this movie to scratch that Amazon itch I apparently do have somewhere deep down.
That's not an itch I possess at all.
Apparently not. And plus, this is probably as close to the Amazon I'm going to get, even though I think pretty much the whole movie was filmed in Tallahassee, something like that. Still, I'd sign up to investigate the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Okay, my number five, it starts with a couple of questions. Am I allowed to pick a journey that could theoretically happen in real life, or only one that can happen within the construct of a movie? The other question, am I taking the place of the characters or traveling with the characters? And this one's complicated by the fact with my number five choice that the characters are real people. This is truly a movie expedition in that the point of the journey is to make a movie. I said there couldn't be a Werner Herzog film on my list.
My number five is Grizzly Man,
The Cave of Forgotten Dreams. I don't need to be eaten by a bear. Spoiler alert. Thank you, Josh.
Okay.
No, but this is a bit of a weird choice for me because I'm insanely claustrophobic. I don't love caves. And there's a cave in the title. But part of the fun here, Josh, for me in making this choice is thinking about being part of the crew that gets to travel with Werner Herzog to Chauvet Cave in France, where you get to see 30,000-year-old paintings, these drawings on the cave walls that Herzog suggests. It is as if the modern human soul was created here. Now, I mentioned I'm claustrophobic. A couple summers ago with the family, we went to Table Rock Lake in Missouri. We went into Arkansas, went to Onyx Cave. I can do it. I can do a cave if, like the ones in the Cave of Forgotten Dreams, they're fairly big.
You could stand up in them.
I can stand up.
I think they are fairly big.
They are. I watched some clips and they didn't make me queasy. There's a lot of space. There's some light for them. That works. Now, when I went to the Onyx Cave, I was fine until there was one little tunnel where I was at the back of the line.
Mm.
And we got into it and the line stopped, which I didn't anticipate. So all of a sudden, I'm stuck in the dark in a tunnel where I've got about a foot of headspace. And that wasn't fun. And I made sure that going back through it on the way out, I didn't repeat that mistake.
Did you nudge the kids with your elbows aside? Did you trample on any elderly women to get to the front of the line, Adam?
Do you have footage from this or something? I'm not going to comment. But as an appreciator of art of all kinds, I just couldn't pass up the opportunity to see with my own eyes those earliest artistic expressions. Herzog's talking about the modern human soul. You could expect him to be quite lofty, but another profound bit he expresses is, in a forbidden recess of the cave, there's a footprint of an 8-year-old boy next to the footprint of a wolf. Did the hungry wolf stalk the boy, or did they walk together as friends, or were their tracks made thousands of years apart? We'll never know. Now, of course, that would have been much better with a Bavarian accent, and I apologize to everyone, but Herzog even goes so far as to suggest that these paintings might have been the beginning of cinema, and that some of them do seem to capture movement. So seeing all of that would be enough for me to draw me into that cave, and Werner Herzog being with me would just be the icing on the cake.
I can see you sitting there at his feet, listening to that. Maybe you could run like the craft services table.
I'd be fine with that.
Hand him a cup of lemonade when you got thirsty.
There you go.
So the question of, are we accompanying these people/characters? Yeah, this might come into play with my number four. We'll see what you think. I did get a lot of suggestions on social media for Into the Wild, which I do
Again,
love.
Have they seen how that movie plays out?
Exactly. Briefly considered it. Instead, I went with the similarly themed Wild. This is the one where Reese Witherspoon plays memoirist Cheryl Strayed. She attempted a 1,100-mile solo hike along the Pacific Crest Trail to reset her personal compass. I'm a sucker for these finding yourself in the wilderness narratives. I don't really feel like there's a self I need to find. It's not really that existential for me.
Everything about you so on the surface.
There is something about the challenge of being out there on your own that's pretty compelling. And, you know, really, just the idea of being out there on your own, there are some days where I'd like to test my introvert limits, and this sounds like a good way to definitely do that. So now, why Wild over Into the Wild? Well, Strayed, she's a novice hiker, true, but I think she's still better prepared than Christopher McCandless.
She starts out over-prepared.
Over-prepared, really. And I also think that at this point, I can relate more to the notion of going wild to reassess your life, where it's at, than, you know, this sort of, what would you say, youthful, starry-eyed exuberance that McCandless had.
Yeah, and you think that loneliness is the answer, that isolation
exactly
is the answer.
Yeah, that you're making that choice for good. And really, as you indicated too, you'd much rather end up where Strayed did than face McCandless's tragic end. So I don't know what this means for that question of, are you with them or not? Because this is a solo hike, right? The whole point was that she was on her own. That's sort of what appeals to me. So I don't know. I don't know how that lands here.
Okay. I like that choice. And it's a fitting one for me to follow up with my number four, because that same question of knowing how things play out factors in. The way I phrased it here, Josh, the question was, do you have the benefit of hindsight on these movie expeditions? I'm going to say, at least for my purposes here, that I don't. The outcome of the film is irrelevant because I'm going with the 2012 Ridley Scott movie. 2012 Ridley Scott movie that you didn't like, Prometheus.
Oh, my goodness.
Obviously, I wouldn't be too interested in fending off the variety of threats the crew faces over the course of that film. And again, my claustrophobia rearing its head, I would never knowingly be put in stasis. I hate it in any space movie I watch where they just willingly get in those canisters and close the lid and fall asleep forever. Nope, not going to happen. But beyond that, space travel, which I'm into, okay. First thing I ever wanted to do because of The Right Stuff, another movie I considered for this list, was go into space, was to be an astronaut. So space travel plus a mission to discover the origins of humanity, the search for God.
Is that what they were doing in there?
Yes, it was, Josh. You may have forgotten. The cave I talked about, Chauvet Cave, that offers the chance to see where the modern human soul was invented, where humans created art as expressions of their existence. This would be the chance to see who created humans, who created the very notion of existence. Are we too, Josh, a form of artistic expression for those creators? That would have sounded better as well with a Bavarian accent. The real kicker here, like my Herzog choice, maybe I get to travel with Michael Fassbender. In android form or not.
There it is.
It doesn't matter.
There it is.
I'm with Film Spotting Madness champion Michael Fassbender.
I am glad you're going on this expedition. You can come back and explain to me what the heck was going on in that movie.
Or not.
Number three for me. Another suggestion I saw a lot on Facebook and Twitter was Hayao Miyazaki's Spirited Away. But I'm going with his 1997 echo fable, Princess Mononoke. I like it even more than Spirited Away, and it really has more of an expedition element to it. Here, a prince journeys to a faraway land where he ends up brokering a peace between these protective animal gods of the forest and the human marauders who are devouring the environment. This has a crucial element to any good expedition movie: increasingly amazing encounters with bizarre characters along the way. This movie starts out with this demon boar who curses the prince, and then that sends him on his journey to find a cure. Then we meet a human girl who rides a wolf, a giant forest spirit who marches through the woods at night, and the great Lady Eboshi, an arms merchant who made, I think, your list for sure, and maybe mine as well, when we did our top five Miyazaki characters on episode 478. So this is a grand journey, grand expedition, bizarre characters. Sounds good to me, Princess Mononoke.
Yeah, sounds good to me as well, but maybe not as good as my number three. I mentioned some of my choices being relatively safe. Well, this one is a downright comfortable expedition.
Oh, no.
This is what I need in an expedition, Josh.
No spas allowed either.
Okay, there are no spa treatments that I can remember in this film.
I thought we'd go M1, M6, come off at Junction 31, and there's a short drive on the A59 to Clitheroe. From there, it's a very short hop to Whitewell.
And how long will that take?
About 4 hours.
4 hours? Not very much.
The Trip. Michael Winterbottom, Steve Coogan, Rob Brydon. I think you still haven't seen any of these movies.
Have not.
Which is shameful.
This would have been my opportunity.
It would have been. This is another one, like The Cave of Forgotten Dreams, that is at least theoretically possible, if not practically so. I mean, I could recreate their steps, and I could travel around northern England, later Italy in the follow-up, and coming soon, Spain, with a buddy, all expenses paid, going restaurant to restaurant, trying amazing food. What could be better than that? Now, what could be better is not having to write about any of those trips, which I think at least in the first film, ostensibly, they're supposed to be doing. It's an assignment for The Guardian, and stressing out about what I would be writing would be enough to make me too neurotic to actually enjoy any of the food and drink. But take that part out and I'm golden. And then on top of it, if I actually got to be a third wheel and just observe Coogan and Brydon doing Michael Caine impressions all day long, well, there's actually nothing more I want out of life. That is my dream.
Oh, man.
That's my dream existence.
Michael Caine's voice now in the Batman movies and in Harry Brown. I can't go fast because Michael Caine talks very, very slowly.
Right, this is how Michael Caine speaks.
You are really stretching the definition of expedition here. I mean, when your biggest challenge is what to leave for a tip, I don't think that counts.
Counts in my world.
Oh, boy. Number two, King Kong. And I'm going with the 1933.
What?
Or, of course.
You're making yourself out to be way braver than you are.
Man, I would do all of these things before I'd hop in the back seat with those two. Absolutely.
You're insane. I don't believe you.
I am picking the original. This is the one that the Next Picture Show folks, they recently paired with Kong Skull Island. The first one had what the remakes will never be able to replicate, that sense of going into the truly unknown and finding something you couldn't have ever imagined. That's what happens to Carl Denham, the documentary filmmaker who sets sail in the original to investigate these rumors of a strange creature on a remote island. And what's important to remember here is the original audience for King Kong, they were right there with him, right? They didn't know what to expect, and they'd certainly never seen effects quite like what Willis O'Brien managed on the screen. Now, this is why I'm so glad I saw this for the first time when I was a little kid. A lot of these expeditions, you could tell, are like just reliving my youth. I could experience the movie somewhat in the same way, have that same sort of awe. I mean, it was, what, probably the 70s or maybe early 80s, but for me, not having seen any other Kong pictures or really all that much cinema, it was this landmark viewing experience. So yeah, a little dangerous, but I'm not crazy. They made it off the island. They all made it back. King Kong.
Yeah, wasn't dangerous at all, as I recall.
No, there were a few hiccups.
Well, your apparent swashbuckler approach to life did allow you here to pick much more traditional, though not any less inspired, movie expeditions. But a nice segue as you talk about reliving your youth with my number two. I'm going to let Richard Dreyfuss do the honors here.
I was 12 going on 13 the first time I saw a dead human being. It happened in the summer of 1959, a long time ago, but only if you measure in terms of years.
Stand By Me, of course. And this one came from M. Robert Turnage, another one of our Film Spotting Advisory Board members, who wrote, "I would walk through the woods with my buddies to see a dead body. I'm not sure what process will allow me to actually revert back to my 12-year-old self, but that's required for this choice, obviously. The notion of seeing a dead body, not much of a hook now, and probably wasn't even then. But heading out on that clandestine mission with my best friends, getting into a little danger, unknowingly testing your readiness for adulthood, those are the memories you never forget, that you recall more vividly than things that, Josh, happened to us last week or last month, because that's when and where you discover who you really are. And there are experiences that are often extreme in some way. You're on the verge of adolescence, but you are also, I think, figuring yourself out in relation to other people. And in this case, friends who you know and trust more than anyone else in your life. I also like about this, Josh, that it's just about my level of camping. They're just in Oregon. They're not out in the desert. They're not in the jungle. Beautiful forests, lakes, mountains, quite scenic. You avoid the trains.
Got to ease you into the camping.
You're pretty good. And that's why Stand By Me is my number two.
You're getting back on track here. I like this. I think a general rule of thumb for you is an expedition, you can't sleep in your own bed at night.
Right.
Which Stand By Me still
that's it.
Kind of allows.
That's all I need. That's my criterion.
All right. You're getting there.
I'd be sleeping like on a sleeping bag on the ground.
Can you imagine that?
I can only imagine it because I don't do it.
My number one, you're gonna entirely disapprove of. The Fellowship of the Ring, for a variety of reasons you're going to disapprove of.
Right. Again, so safe.
Well, it is safe. It feels safe to me. That's part of what appealed about this. This also is another expedition that I imagined being a part of as a kid when I first read the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I don't know, must probably have been about third grade or so. Frodo, Gandalf, Gimli, Legolas, there's such camaraderie among these and the other characters that as a reader, then as a viewer with Peter Jackson's 2001 adaptation, you never really feel unmatched for the many challenges that they face. You know, you've got this group around you and you can, like Frodo, just kind of sit and watch. And I know he becomes more active, but really there's ghostly ring wraiths. You're right. There's orcs. There's the cave troll. Mm-hmm. There's the demonic Balrog. Am I getting nerdy enough for you?
Adam, I zoned out. I zoned out
like literally
60 seconds
over.
Ago.
Now I know how to hypnotize you. I'll just say
really?
Demonic Balrog.
Oh, man.
He's out. One of the reasons Jackson's Fellowship hit such a sweet spot for me is because it combined that wild fantasy of Tolkien's narrative with these real-world locations of Jackson's native New Zealand. And really, That's like an earthly fantasy realm, the topography of New Zealand. There's some amazing stuff there. I think there might have been an Earth Watchers trip to New Zealand, too, I tried to get on as a little kid. Maybe I can. You're going to come with me in this time.
Uh-huh.
Fellowship is my number one, then. It's because the expedition here pushes both my fantasy nerd and my geography nerd buttons. Sorry to talk so much Tolkien there.
No, Adam. Well done. And I knew it was coming, of course, because you may not be aware, but Sam and I talk about you behind the scenes, and he did.
That was his prediction.
He did send me a chat and say, are you prepared for all of the Lord of the Rings talk? And I said, just have the Clerks 2 soundbite handy.
Three movies of people walk into a volcano.
No, here's it's a good pick, movie. And I expected nothing less. Now,
I'm assuming since you expected it, you did watch The Two Towers and Return of the King to be prepared, right? Hmm. Did you?
I've seen The Fellowship of the Ring, so yeah. I'm good.
No.
I'm good.
There's two other movies.
I don't know what you're talking about. Let's see if you approve of my number one.
Do you get to sleep in your own bed at night?
No, but I am definitely stretching.
So far.
I'm definitely stretching the definition of an expedition.
It's a very odd thing. It's supernatural, for lack of a better word. I mean, it raises all sorts of philosophical type questions, you know, about the nature of self, about the existence of a soul, you know? Am I me? Is Malkovich Malkovich? I had a piece of wood in my hand, Maxine. I don't have it anymore. Where is it? Did it disappear? How could that be? Is it still in Malkovich's head? I don't know. Do you see what a metaphysical can of worms this portal is? I don't see how I could go on living my life the way I've lived it before.
This is your most daring one.
Heady stuff.
Yeah.
Pun intended. I didn't anticipate this theme developing here with my picks from The Cave of Forgotten Dreams and Prometheus, and even the trip in Stand By Me get pretty existential. It may be a bit of a cheat, Josh, because, yes, I'm merely journeying, literally anyway, from the 7.5 floor of a New York City building to the Jersey Turnpike. That's not much. But how many times in your life have you imagined what it would truly be like to walk in another person's shoes, to see the world through another person's eyes, to possess a consciousness other than your own? I've thought about it quite a bit, and what a gift and what a potential curse, as the movie shows us, that opportunity would be. So that's a journey I want to go on. It's the journey I most want to go on, and that's why being John Malkovich is my number one. Thank you, Greg Berlin from the FAB, for reminding me of that great Spike Jonze film.
And that freaks me out.
Yeah.
I'd rather be in a sleeping bag in the woods any day.
With bears?
I'm not going grizzly, man.
What about demonic Balrogs?
Yeah, I can handle that.
You're fine with that. Okay. Those are our top five movie expeditions we'd sign up for. Josh, any honorable mentions?
A great suggestion on Facebook from Chad Camello, The Straight Story. I like his explanation to summer lawnmower ride. Sounds pretty soothing, actually. Would you do that?
Yeah,
okay,
totally.
All right, you're good with that.
It's about my speed.
Romancing the Stone, maybe. You know, I can't pick Raiders because it's in the Pantheon.
Right.
So maybe this silly Raiders knockoff would do the trick. I don't know.
Well, I mentioned The Right Stuff earlier. A lot of people on social media said Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, I saw
and of
that.
Course, I almost went with that because, of course, I would want to go on that journey, but it's too easy, so I ruled it out. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. You get the time travel element, and you actually get to meet historical figures.
True.
That sounds great. My other heady choice, Josh, is Solaris. Think about it.
I'm not doing that.
The
that
journey to the planet Solaris.
Messed up.
It's messed up, but every person you've loved, who you've lost, reappears to you. Whether it's quote-unquote real or not, it feels real. And
it doesn't go
Adam. It doesn't go well, but again, do we have the benefit of hindsight? If you're just signing up for the initial mission, of course, they're not signing up for that mission, but that's what they encounter, and it'd be tough to turn down.
Bon voyage and good luck.
Yeah. Those are, again, our top five movie expeditions. We would love to hear which movie trips you'd sign up for. You can continue to shame me. You can support Josh on all of the Lord of the Rings films. They made a few more Hobbit ones, as I recall. Feedback at filmspotting.net.
You may recall you've seen one of the Hobbit
ones. I saw
ones.
One of them. Mm-hmm. I did. That is our show at filmspotting.net. You can find 12 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. We do hope you enjoy the revamped filmspotting.net. If you have any comments about it, if there's anything about the site you are looking for and can't find, yes, there is a link on most pages to the archive on the original site. It's there, I promise you. But if there's any other features or something you think would be worth adding, I'd love to hear it. Feedback at filmspotting.net.
Is it .net or .org?
No, still .net.
Still .net. Okay.
And if you go to .org, that will take you to the same place.
Okay,
so either one works. While you are at the site, you can vote in the latest film spotting poll. If you have to watch a film, but all you know about it is that it stars one of these four young actresses, all born in 1990, which one would you choose? The choices: Lawrence, Robbie, Stewart, or Watson. And if you haven't already, check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Out in wide release, The Circle, with Tom Hanks and the aforementioned Emma Watson. It's an adaptation of the Dave Eggers novel about the sinister motives of a seemingly benign tech company. It's directed by James Ponsell. We've enjoyed his work in The End of the Tour and The Spectacular Now. How to Be a Latin Lover, a new comedy directed by Ken Marino from The State, and he's part of that David Wayne ensemble that is out as well. In limited release, Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent. This is a documentary about a famed chef who, Josh, I previously had not heard of, but he became known in Berkeley in the 70s for being the main chef at Chez Panisse, and then he went on to run Stars, which was this famous restaurant in San Francisco, mainly in the 80s. Like all good documentaries, it's got a fascinating core subject, Jeremiah Tower himself, and he has a fascinating story. And you don't have to care about food or cooking, I think, to appreciate this film. It's a tormented artist story, someone battling all the forces that can stifle an artist's vision from being fully realized, whether it's the need to collaborate with other people, rely on owners and other cooks in the kitchen, or societal demands and events that are outside your control, or certainly it's the case with Jeremiah Tower, your own demons. But he could be a rock star, he could be a filmmaker, he could be an athlete. That all said, if you are a food person, I think you'll be rewarded too, because it's very much about his specific approach to cooking and what made him unique and what made his restaurants unique.
Will it make me hungry?
And that may be the most important question. Yes, 100%.
All right, good.
It will make you hungry. Next week on the show, we will have our summer movie preview along with a review of quite possibly the summer's big movie, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. And we're doing this like we've been doing our previews, Josh. We're going to share our top five questions about the summer movie season. And that actually gives us a chance to cheat a little bit and often sneak in more than five titles. We're not just doing the five movies we're most excited about. We want to know your questions or even your titles. What movies are you really anticipating this summer? Leave us a voicemail and we may use it in next week's show. 312-264-0744. Or, of course, you can send us an MP3 file.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Jeremy Wellhausen. Thanks to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Our music this week comes from Finn Regan. You can hear it on the album The Meetings of the Waters. More information is at finnregan.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kepinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
So the funny part about you mistakenly saying lasso for Indiana Jones, the only reason I really even knew to correct you so quickly is because back when I was writing reviews for the Daily Iowan, have been...
You called it a lasso in print?
This must have been 2001. Yeah, June 2001. I was still pretty new to it and, well, maybe a year in, but hadn't written a ton of reviews. And I wrote a review of Lara Croft Tomb Raider and I hated the movie, but I was really proud of myself for some of my turns of phrase in that review. I wrote this, Josh, because I have it in front of me. Based solely on appearance, the freaky, feisty Jolie was the perfect choice to portray cyber babe Lara Croft. Unfortunately, the recent Academy Award winner's acting is as uninspired as Simon West's direction. She uses the same facial expression to convey every emotion, an odd mixture of surprise and sensuality, like a confused deer caught in the headlights trying to decide whether to move out of the way or mate with the oncoming vehicle. So I was proud of myself for that, right? And then I said,
all sorts of terrible images in my head right now.
I close with this. Likewise, for all you women hoping to find a new role model in this smart, sexy, ass-kicking archaeologist, you'll probably be disappointed unless perhaps you're a card-carrying member of the NRA. Unlike Indiana Jones, who uses his intellect and his trusty whip to escape from sticky situations, Lady Laura Croft just shoots her way out. So here I am. I'm like, this might be my best review. And unfortunately, it's a pan, but I'm just patting myself on the back.
This is going to make me famous.
The next day, I get an email from one of my friends who's a huge Indiana Jones fan, and he says, Indiana Jones doesn't use a lasso.
Oh, so you did write lasso.
This is the internet where I can correct my mistakes. In print, I wrote—
There should be an asterisk there.
Lasso.
The original version of this terrible review.
I wrote lasso like an idiot.
Well, what's embarrassing about me making that mistake is I was Indiana Jones for Halloween.
I almost said that.
And I had a
whip. Did you call it a lasso?
I had a— No. Are you kidding? It's old age. This is what happens.
It does. Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.